the intro.
Hello. Hello. And welcome to Coffee with Cashy. I'm your host, Dr. Trevor Cashy. Today's host, co-host, the Monster Energy Zero Ultra coffee, flavored coffee substitute. Super delicious, okay? This next mini-series, maybe three or four lessons long, it's about the facets of self-control, cracking the code of self-control. This is part number one. And I'm just going to hop right into this, okay? There's 3 points that we are covering today, you and I are covering today. Point number one is that thoughts are the most important determinant of our emotions and our actions. Point number two is that the need for control creates stress and misery, and that stress and misery leads to greater need for control. And then the third point you and I are covering is that there are 3 major pathways to changing our thoughts. And that leads us back to point number one, and that's that thoughts are the most important determinant of our emotions and actions. And guess what determines our outcomes, our actions, okay? So people tend to think that stimulus leads right to response. They tend to think that an event occurs and they do something because of that event, right? No, this is mistaken. We build urges to act based on how we feel about the situation. And we feel how we think, okay? Even though an event does occur, we're the ones passing judgment based on what we think is happening and because of experiences in the past, okay? Cultivating awareness of the thinking that leads to those judgments, especially the distorted thinking, is the bedrock of acting rationally, which is the key to self-control, okay? If we catch ourselves thinking distorted thoughts, it makes sense to course correct and be on our way. Because if you think in silly things, you're going to feel silly things and you'll do silly stuff. So if you catch it, well, then you can correct it immediately. However, it's silly to try and be conscious of all of our thoughts all the time. It's absurd. Especially because so much of our thought processing is so heavily ingrained, we tend to miss it happening. Although it is happening. It is. For that reason, it makes the most sense to investigate our thinking in 2 types of situations. 1, the situations where we feel particularly bad and do dumb stuff. And 2, the situations where we feel particularly good and do smart stuff. This way we can do less dumb stuff and feel less bad, and do more smart stuff and feel more good. The most effective way to investigate these situations is to invoke the principle of variable outcomes. That is, A, to make direct comparisons between people that have a wide variety of responses to the same stimulus, the same situation, and B, make direct comparisons to how we change the way we respond to the same thing under different circumstances. If we expose 1,000 people to the same thing, some of those people will feel bad and do dumb stuff, and then make themselves feel worse and do even dumber stuff, and some people will feel good and do smart stuff, and then make themselves feel even better and do smarter stuff. If we expose ourselves to the same stimulus under 1,000 different conditions, then our responses and outcomes will vary similarly. The rational thinker can then infer, through the principle of variable outcomes, that what we do and the results we get depend heavily on the way we think about the situation. Then, by inferential chaining, the rational person perceives, well, if I want different outcomes, I best act differently. And if I'm to act differently, then I best think differently. Since our thoughts are ours, we are responsible for them. And that's good. It means we can change them. If we think a dumb thing that leads to dumb stuff, well, then we can change that to thinking a smart thing and do smarter stuff and get better results. Pretty sweet. And that leads us to point number 2, the thing that gums up the works. Because it makes sense to think smart stuff all the time, and sometimes we think dumb stuff anyway, so what gives? Right? It's one thing to change something dumb into something smart. It's another thing, like, why are we thinking dumb stuff to begin with? Well, that's point number 2. And that's that the need for control creates stress and misery. And that stress and misery leads to a greater need for control. If we attach our sanity, our self-worth, and our well-being to external events, well, then we write ourselves a prescription for chronic frustration and anxiety and misery and stress. It's insane. It's insanity. And we commonly think about situations so that we can change something or somebody else's reaction. And those things, even when we act perfectly, are to some degree up to chance. It's up to chance. We painstakingly plan to get reactions we want from things external to us. Change the way other things react. Change the way other people react. Things external to us. We rarely spend any time at all painstakingly planning our own reactions. The reactions of other people are up to them. The outcome of any situation is always on a spectrum of probability. There's a high chance or a low chance. Is anything guaranteed besides death and taxes? It's encouraged to want what you want and also to enjoy it when you get it. Once we attach our well-being to the outcome of an external event, we start putting tons of pressure on ourselves. We become neurotic and impulsive and then do silly stuff. And this ends up sabotaging our outcomes, which then makes us even stronger need for control that results in, well, more pressure and more neuroticism and more dumb stuff, etc. and so on and so forth. So to link the first two points together, we think we have a greater influence over the outcomes of external events than we really do. We decide it's a good idea to have our sanity, our self-worth, and our happiness depend on the outcomes of those external things. That is dumb, because the outcomes of external things are mainly up to chance. And when the outcome of an event deviates from our expectations, it makes it harder to do smart stuff and easier to do dumb stuff. And the more dumb stuff we do, the more we sabotage our outcomes and the more miserable we feel, the more we want control, and right? So the rational person knows the more smart stuff we do, the more likely we'll get the outcomes we want. So it's best we impose order where we can on ourselves. To become conscious of these vicious cycles that lead to chaos, misery, and doing dumb stuff, and to replace them with virtuous cycles that lead to doing smart stuff, which means tranquility and achievement. Okay? This leads to our third point for today's lesson, and that's that there are three major pathways to changing our thoughts, to changing our beliefs. You can change them with language, we can change them with imagery, and we can change them with experiences. So let's throw down a few examples to give an idea. Let's start with language. Dr. Cashy's favorite way of challenging beliefs and thoughts is through rational methods like disputation, actually filing a dispute with ourselves, arguing points back and forth with logic and reason to determine the validity or the futility of our beliefs. In a nutshell, this means assessing and comparing how logical, empirical, and practical our beliefs are. Logical is, well, does this make any sense? Do things follow smoothly? You know? Then there's empirical, which is there any legit evidence supporting this belief? And after that, there's the practical, whereas, is there anything actionable from thinking this way? Even if it is logical and there is evidence to support it, can we do anything with it? What are the options if we can? And if so, are those things likely to help us? And then, well, what is a more effective belief to hold in a situation? If the logic is kind of bad and the evidence is kind of weak and, you know, the actions that we can take from them kind of take us down a lame path, or maybe there's just no actions at all and we think ourselves in circles, right? So what is a more effective belief to hold in a situation like this that is more logical, that is more empirical, that is more practical? What are some alternative beliefs that we can have that are more effective? Okay. Next, we move on to imagery. And this is about normalizing how we feel and changing what we see, essentially by taking different perspectives. To visualize where things go when taken to all extremes, tiny and enormous, and left and right and sideways and slantways, like Willy Wonka's elevator, okay? To really lean into what would happen by imagining things in fine detail, like really, really immersing yourself into the thoughts of like actually creating a visual of what would happen in very fine detail, okay? To lean into the sensations that that sort of imagery would give you so that you could normalize yourself to the types of intense emotions and sensations that you would feel, and then allowing it to equilibrate while you are leaning into that visualization. To view other people's experiences. What are the experiences other people have had? Putting yourself in their shoes, you know, drawing upon that principle of variable outcomes. What did they experience? What did they see? How does that help us? And then to see how others view our experiences. What does this look like from the outside, looking back in? Instead of looking at the same situation differently as us, or what if we look at this situation as if we were somebody else? What does it actually look like, the imagery? And then there's probably the granddaddy of them all, and that's correction by astronomy. And that's just to think in terms of the vast swath of time and space, you know, tiny blip, tiny planet, tiny amount of time and all eternity. Is it really, really worth spending the time and energy that we're spending on this in the grand scheme? What is this like in the grand scheme of things? Is it really anything? To which then you can loop back to the language portion. And is this logical, empirical, practical? What is the more effective way to think once you've used imagery to help normalize the situation? And then last, and probably the most effective in a lot of circumstances, is that of experience. And the primary method here that Dr. Kashi likes to use, that TKN uses, is self-monitoring. So it's gathering experience, right? It's having experiences that conflict with your beliefs in such a way that it provides you evidence that makes it easier for us to change what we believe so that we can do less dumb stuff and do more smart stuff. And again, the primary method here is self-monitoring, where we actually keep track of what we are doing to see if it adds up with what we currently believe about the situation. Okay, we do that over time and we collect some information and then we analyze it with somebody, a coach or something, or somebody that we trust, okay? Then there's stress inoculation, and that is to expose ourselves to situations. So this is kind of like what imagery is meant for in the earlier stage, but stress inoculation is the next step further, where we actually expose ourselves to situations that feel bad and work us up on purpose, but do it with purpose, and continue exposing ourselves to that situation until we feel neutral about it. And when I say feel neutral, I actually mean as a sensation, right? As an emotion and a sensation. That's what I mean by feeling. That you're still allowed to detest it. You're still allowed to really have a problem with the situation and prefer to avoid it. However, that is different than working yourself up, like physiologically, when you're exposed. Because when that happens, it clouds your thinking and makes it easier to do dumb stuff. So if whenever we get exposed to a situation that works us up, we're more likely to do dumb stuff. And if we can have a problem with something, and also stay calm when we are experiencing it in real time, well, then that puts us back in the driver's seat so we can do more smart stuff and stack up some more constructive outcomes, okay? And the last example we have here is direct experimentation, which is closer to stress inoculation, except it's really less about exposing yourself to something that stresses you out and more about going out with a plan that maybe you're skeptical of. That maybe you think, this isn't going to work, and you do it anyway. And you go out and you try new things and you combine it with self-monitoring so that you can really give it an honest and genuine try to try something new and gather information and see if that information actually does match with what you believe or deviate with what you believe so that you can then apply your rational disputation, your rational thinking to determine, is this a good way? Is this a good direction to keep going? Or is it better off that we change something? Okay. So that ends our first lesson on cracking the self-control code, right? The first one. We got a couple more coming. Thank you so much for learning. Stay rational. Until next time. Want to continue having coffee with Dr. Kashi? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is very much appreciated. Thank you, and see you next week. Dr. Kashi is out.